And today I'm in Elstree, Hertfordshire, with Alan Newman, a well-known author and ex-book maker. Alan, can you, for those that don't know you, can you introduce yourself and tell us a bit about yourself, please?
Obviously, my name is Alan Newman, also known as Ginger. I'm nearly 78 years of age, and I've been in the bookmaking, gambling business basically all my life. I can remember going to Wembley Stadium during the war when I was 4 years old, because they only had greyhound racing in the afternoon, and that was my first recollection of greyhound racing. And even today, it's still the love of my life.
Can you give us some background when you first got involved with actual bookmaking or betting even?
Well, my father was a bookmaker before me. He started making a book at the old Wembley Stadium in 1932. Wembley opened as a dog track in 1928, and the reports say that there were 70,000 people for the first meeting. My actual introduction to being a bookmaker was basically round about when I was 16. I started to go to Hackney Wick, which is now the Olympic Stadium. I used to go to Wembley, and I used to be more of a runaround at Wembley, going and getting the tees and going up on the photo finish line. I wanted to go to Wimbledon, but they wouldn't allow me in at Wimbledon because I wasn't old enough. You had to be 18 to get into a dog track. I really started at Hackney Wick working for a guy called Izzy, who was actually the clerk for my father. Hackney Wick worked out pretty good because it was a Thursday afternoon and a Saturday morning, so it didn't interfere with the other tracks that we were working at. And from then on, it just progressed. I actually started to make a book when I was 18 years old. I wanted to bet at Wembley, but my father wouldn't let me bet there. He said, you've got to learn a bit, and I want you to learn the hard way. So I said, what do you mean the hard way? So he said, go to a flapping track. He said, you'll find out what the hard way is. And I was actually about 18 and a week old, and I went to a place called Rayleigh, which is near Southend, on a Saturday night, when I think the first race was 10 o'clock at night, but had to be over by 12 o'clock, because it was Sunday laws. I've got to laugh to myself thinking what it was all about. And that was the first place I ever actually made a book.
Now, you've written a book as well as making some books. You just want to show us that one. And tell us a little bit about the story behind when you decided to write this.
I wrote this book. This is a story of a story sort of thing. My granddaughter had just finished university at Birmingham. And while she was there, she lived with four other girls or five other girls in a house. And they lived together for 2 years. And even today, they're all still very friendly. And they used to want to come to somebody's house every month to keep tabs of what was going on amongst themselves. And one day it was my granddaughter's turn to have them over to her. And as I knew them, because we used to go to Birmingham to visit my granddaughter every couple of months, we were invited for dinner. And after dinner, one of the girls said to me, Alan, what do you do? And I said to her, well, I do a bit of this and a bit of that. That's one of my favorite sayings. And she said, no, what's this and that? I said, well, now I'm basically semi-retired. I work a couple of days in my nephew's office and a couple of days at the dogs. And she said, at the dogs? What do you mean at the dogs? And I related to her that I was actually a bookmaker on a dog track. And she said to me, tell me a story about the dogs. And I related a story to her about the dogs. And from then, when I finished relating the story, she said to me, if you could put that on paper, you could write a book. I had to turn sideways to get out the door because I think my head had swung so much.
I've seen some of your stories on the Star Sports website. And there's one particular one that I really enjoyed about your brother turning a pound into a year's wages. Can you tell us that one?
Yeah, it was at Hackney Wick on the, I think it was a Thursday afternoon. It might have been, it could have been Thursday or Saturday. My brother was the tic-tac man at Hackney Wick. I was the floor man, bag man, tea boy, whatever it was. And it was the first race of the day. My brother turned around and in the tic-tac language, he said to me, "What price is the six dog?" I showed him in tic-tac that it was 3-1. He said to me, again in tic-tac, "Put a pound on it." And that was actually our wages for the day. We got a pound each. And the dog won. He backed in that day, or in that morning, six dogs. Every one of them had won. We then went on to White City, where we worked for our father. And again, I was a runaround, and my brother was the tic-tac. And he said to me, a certain race came along, and he asked me what price a dog was. And I showed him it was 7-2 on. And he said to me, again in tic-tac, "Put £2,800 on it. You bet a 2,800 to 8 on a dog." But I even remember the name of the bookmaker. The bookmaker's name was Nat Newman, no relationship. And the name of the dog, and I don't know how I can remember it, but it was called Pigalle Wonder, owned by Al Burnett, who finished up winning the Derby. That was one of the stories of knowing a successful gambler. My father found out what my brother had done and he barred him from ever going to the dogs again.
And did he stick to that barring? Or did
he did, yeah. He never went to a dog track again.
So apart from being a bookmaker on dog tracks, were you ever a bookmaker at horse racing?
No, not a bookmaker at horse racing, but a bookmaker on... betting shops. We had 5 betting shops. We also had a casino. And that's where I, some of the things that I write about in my book comes to the me naming the book, It's Not What You Know. Because I learnt from the casino business, the more people you know, the more doors you can open. And I really believe in today, it's not what you know, it's who you know.
So were you involved as an owner at all?
Again, no. That was one of my father's written or unwritten rules, I should have said, that if you owned a dog, you get influenced. And being a bookmaker, my father didn't want to be influenced. He was a strict bookmaker in the respect that he used to work out the odds, have the percentage, and as long as the percentage was the right way, my father wanted to take bets, not have bets. And that's why we never ever had a dog, apart from pets at home, but never any greyhounds.
Okay, so what you've been very modest so far about the book, but I understand you've raised rather a lot of money for a charity through writing it, is that correct?
Yeah, what happened is I was writing the book for my own enjoyment and I was going to probably get 40 copies printed and give them away for Christmas presents. While I was writing this book, my wife became ill and I didn't write very much and then unfortunately she passed away. And I have a guy who helped with the book called Dave Stewart, who phoned me up a few months later and said to me, "Alan, what are you going to do with the book?" And I thought about it and I said to him, "You know, there's nothing I'm going to do." And he turned around to me and said, "Well, why don't you finish whatever you're going to do? Write an obituary." And for one moment I thought, what's he talking about? But he said, no, not about your wife or anything like that, but about the obituary of dog tracks, the closing and the deaths of all the dog tracks. And he said, "Finish it off, and then we'll publish or print a few, and if we sell them, any profit we'll give to the hospice where my wife died, which was the Peace Hospice in Watford." And I finished the book, we got it printed, and as of today, which August will be 2 years, from donations and sales of the book, we have managed to give to the hospice about £82,000. I still go to the hospice every 5 or 6 weeks, and I take in, because they have like a reception for patients' families, and there's like a tea bar, and I take in tea and biscuits. Not just me, there's lots of people do the same. So I still have a very close connection. We have a golf tournament coming up, and I try and get prizes and things for the auction. And anytime I see anybody, I won't say I ask them for a donation, but I tell them about it, and I'm still managing to get money for them. And that's basically one of the best feelings I'm getting out of it.
And is the book still available now?
The book's still available. If anybody wants to go on to Alan Ginger Newman, they can find it. Or if they want to go on to Lulu, the publishers, they will find it on there. It's Not What You Know by Alan Ginger Newman.
Okay, thanks for that, Alan. Everybody go and buy it. You mentioned about the obituary for Greyhound Racing. Now, do you feel that it's actually got that bad?
Well, when I wrote the obituary as such, I mentioned all the tracks that I can remember going to in London. In actual fact, I wrote about one of them that I never ever went to. But I do feel now, because when I did write it, there was Wimbledon. That was still the track. But since then, that has now gone. So it is really, I think I won't say the beginning of the end, I think it's nearly the end of a dog track that we know. Dog tracks today, to my mind, are basically just there for the betting shops. If anybody goes to a track during the week, I don't think they will realise what it's actually all about. I went to Romford, which I still go to a couple of times a month. I was there Wednesday a week ago and counted the actual public in the stadium. Seven people. The bookmaker who I help out bet there Monday just gone. There are three bookmakers, and the turnover, I think it was on 13 races. The turnover between the three bookmakers, I know you're not going to believe it, was £360 for the whole meeting between the three of them. Not one of them took £360. One of them actually took 60, one of them took 90. How can the dogs survive? I mean, as a bookmaking business, they can't, but the difference is now bookmakers are being paid to go to the dogs, and the management of the tracks need the bookmakers for the betting shops. The only thing that really upsets me is that it's so uncompetitive now, because you go to the track and you're basically warned that if you don't bet with a percentage of about 25%, you won't be betting at the track for much longer. When I was a bookmaker, if the percentage was 8-10%, that was norm. 25% is purely for the betting shops, and that's the only reason dog racing is. People really don't go there anymore. Maybe on a Saturday night you'll get a few people, but the rest of the time it's deserted.
Alan, I'm intrigued. What story did you tell the girl that prompted this literary avenue?
Well, I thought about it for a minute or two, and I thought, you know, I've got to tell a story which I remember vividly. And it was when I was making a book at Wembley. It was a night they had a final, because there was about 4,000 people there, which was a big crowd for Wembley, you know, especially Wembley being so vast. And I remember the name of the dog. It was a dog called Whaley Flash. It was owned and trained by a guy called Barry Silkman. Now, people might know Barry Silkman. At one time, he was a professional football player, played for Manchester City. One time, he was a double window or double glazing proprietor. One time, he was a dog trainer. And now today he's a football manager. And he told me a story that he sold a player to Chelsea not that long ago, where he earned nearly £1 million out of it. Sorry, Barry, but I've got to tell the truth. The story I tell is when Barry was the trainer. Now, Barry had this dog called Whaley Flash, really could only run out of track one. If it was in track two, it was already not such a good thing. But he had this dog running out of track one. Whaley Flash was one of the slowest starters you could ever imagine on a dog track. And it came to this race and they put the dogs into the traps and the hare went round, the trap opened. And instead of it just coming out like 4 or 5 lengths behind, it slipped and it lost another 2 or 3 lengths. And it went to the first bend at Wembley, probably 8 lengths behind the last dog. It must have seen at Wembley through the railings the hare going round basically the second bend as he was getting round the first bend. And instead of running round the track, he tried to cross the track and went straight into a lamppost. And the dog just stopped and fell down, never moved. Barry saw it from where he was standing on the other side with a pickup and started to run towards the dog. The dog still never moved. Barry got there, the race was now over. Barry got there and he looked down at the dog, and then all of a sudden Barry went down on his knees in front of the dog. And as I say, there might have been 4,000 people there, but you could hear a pin drop. Barry just on his knees looked at the dog, and I'm sure everybody in the track just looked at the dog. It didn't move. He put his arms underneath it like in a cradle to pick it up, and as he picked it up, the dog's legs fell all different ways. And the dog was dead. And Barry picked it up and started walking back to the kennels. And even to this day, I can hear Barry sobbing his heart out with the tears running down his face. And that was one of the most sort of, I don't know what the word is, but memorable things I've ever seen on a dog track, that there are humans and people did feel what Barry felt. The book I've written, basically, it is a sort of my life story, but it's not really about me so much. It's about the people that I've come across in the business. When I said to my father, I want to go and become a bookmaker, he said to me, okay, he said, you've got to be a bookmaker, but you've got to remember that you're going to meet some characters and you're going to meet the highest of the high and the lowest of the low. And I must tell you, I probably have. I remember going to Ascot when I was 18 years old with Joe Coral. The original Joe Coral took me to Ascot, and we were walking around Ascot and a guy came up to him and we started talking, and Joe said to me, oh, this is Alan, this is Mr. Moore. And I shook hands with Mr. Moore, and when he walked away I said, who's Mr. Moore? And he said, oh, he owns Littlewood's Pools. Oh, right, which was the way of gambling in those days. Then the next minute he comes over with a young lady. To me she was a young lady, and introduced me and said to me, this is Lady Sassoon, which if you could go look at horse racing owners and trainers, they were the epitome. They were the number one owners in those days. And then he's introduced me to a guy called Roy Green. And I said, oh, he was a nice guy. Who's Roy Green? He said, he's a gangster. He's probably got a gun in his pocket. He said, but these are the people you're going to meet. And there was, you know, and I don't know what it was, but in the years that I'm talking about, most people had nicknames. I said, we had a guy called the Swan. And why was he called the Swan? Well, he had the longest neck you've ever seen. Then there was a guy called Murray the Head. Murray the Head was as bald as you could ever imagine anybody to be. But this was before it was a popular thing to shave your head. He was bald. Then there was a guy called Manchester George. Well, Manchester George, I do believe he actually was from Manchester, was the card sharp. Murray the Head and the Swan were diamond hoisters. They used to go into jewellers and put pieces of glass and take the diamonds away. And these are the people that I grew up with on the dog track. What an education I had. I think that was great.
Just one more story, Alan. You mentioned in the book the 5 best bookmakers that you had come across. You want to tell us a bit about them?
Yeah, I mean, I love talking about the five best bookmakers. The five best bookmakers I ever came across, and you've got to remember, this is my opinion. They're all dog bookmakers. When I say dog bookmakers, greyhound bookmakers, and they're all from the south. So, you know, I never bet up north, so I'm sure they're just as good, and you've all got your own opinions, but this is my opinion of the bookmakers. The guy, to my mind, who was the best bookmaker was a guy called Georgie Knight, known as the Legend. Georgie Knight I met when I was 16 at Hackney Wick. He was probably getting on for about 30. He was a big guy, 6'2", and probably weighed 18 stone. Never, ever without a smile on his face. The reason why I give him as the best bookmaker, he could go to any dog track in the world with £10 in his pocket and make a book. You know, he didn't have to go with unlimited money. Somehow he could control his book with £10. The other part about George was that he could go to a track which looks basically deserted, and from nowhere, if there was 10 punters in the track, they would find George. And he had this sort of list of clientele of the best and the worst. And I can assure you, some of these people used to bet with George were the worst. But the story I remember most of all about George was he was betting at Clapton Dog Track with a guy named Bernie Doris, who had a snooker card club in Stoke Newington, just down the road from the dog track. In those days, there were eight races. Yeah, eight races. Can anybody think about it? Eight races, two meetings a week. No, I don't think anybody remembers that. It came to the last race. George was winning £2,000. You could buy probably at least three houses for that in those days. He stood the last favourite for £2,300. And the favourite won. Him and Bernie Doris parted company that night. But I believe after that, George was running a dice game on the snooker table in Bernie Doris's club. He was my number one bookmaker. Number two was Tony Morris, as I known as the professional. Tony Morris, again, he would go to a track, and there were so many people who wanted to bet with Tony Morris. I think he used to get a bus, a double-decker bus, and bring them with. There were so many people. He was a true professional and knew his percentages and was a great, great bookmaker. But George, because of the way he controlled his money, was probably still the best. The only problem with George was, though, that if he finished up with £200 in his pocket that night, he had to go and gamble somewhere else. He'd go to play cards, whatever it was, dice. Knowing that the odds were against him and still play, and I find that hard to believe a man with his knowledge of percentages should play games where he knows that he's going to lose. My third bookmaker was a guy called John Power, or John Jenkins, which is his real name. He and his brother Tom used to bet at Walthamstow. I know John as the Viking. He had long blonde hair down on his shoulders like the Viking soldiers. John's memory, or one of the memories I can remember about John, was when he was betting at Walthamstow. The other bookmakers there hated him because he was so far in advance of the other bookmakers. He would change the odds every second, and the bookmakers were finding it harder and harder to keep up with him. And at one race, I remember, John started to change the prices of the dogs, the whole six dogs. And all the bookmakers did their best to follow him. And as they followed him, John changed the prices again. And all the bookmakers followed him again. What did John do? He did it again. And all the bookmakers followed him again. But by this time, John had put up a percentage that basically, if a punter wanted to back the dogs, he could back the six dogs and show a 3% profit. Doesn't matter what won. And John jumped off the stall and run down to the other four bookmakers and said, I want to back every dog to win £1,000, every dog to win £1,000, meaning that every whichever dog won, John would have won £30. None of the bookmakers bet him, though. The other guy, not being one of my favourite personalities, but is a guy called Roger Kent Barton. I will say Roger is one of the pluckiest bookmakers, especially in the game today, that if you are a punter, he will give you a bet. He doesn't understand the percentages like the other bookmakers at all. He's not a very nice man to bet with, because if you back two or three winners, he tells you to F off. If you don't have a bet with him for two races, he comes and puts his arm around you and says, why don't you bet with me? But he is very, very game. He always, every race he loses on, he rucks the bookmaker, the clerk or the floorman, everybody's fault that he lost on the race. And he had one particular punter, though, known as Robert the Pole. And Robert the Pole, didn't have to see him, but you knew he was in the track, because after two races, all you would find was Scottish money floating about. Robert the Pole was an importer of cigarettes. I don't think they were legitimate somehow. But Robert the Pole came to Romford every meeting, and he would bet with Roger. And it was great to see him stand on the stand, and he'd say to Roger, £2,000, trap fool. And Roger would say, what trap? And trap pool. And we found out he wanted £2,000 on trap two. And this went on for months and months and months, or even years. And this guy used to pay, and it was great to see him have his bets. One night he was doing £14,000 to Roger, and it came to the last race, and he shouted down, Roger, £2,000, trap three. And Roger bet him. The price of the dog was 14-1. So Roger actually laid him a 28,000-2. The dog won. That was the first time I've ever seen Roger couldn't actually speak. He couldn't even have a go at his bookman. It was his own fault. The last bookmaker was a guy called Phil Earle at White City. He used to get on the stand at White City and for the eight races wouldn't get off. One of the reasons was he had a wooden leg. So he'd stand there all night long with his wooden leg. But he was a bookmaker when gambling was in its glorious, glorious days, after the war in the 50s and 60s. And I talk about money. I said that the track, the bookmakers at the track on Romford on Monday took £360 approximately between the three of them. In those days that I'm talking about, when there was eight races at White City, I would imagine they were taking £5,000 a race. But he used to stand there like a rock. Couldn't have a joke with him or his firm because it was a business. But the one thing I will say, whether I used to win or lose, because I was placing bets, I was only 15, 16 at the time, I was placing bets for punters. At the end of the night, I used to get my £2 off of him, win, lose or draw. That's why I was a bloody good bookmaker.
Alan, I do understand that you're enjoying your retirement, still in the game these days. Can you tell us a bit about your adventures?
Well, my current adventures are that I have a very, very old friend of approximately 55 years now, who actually had a share with me when I was making a book at Wembley, who, when I published the book, he came to the day we published it, and he asked me what I'm going to be doing with myself. And I said, well, you know, again, my favourite saying, a bit of this and a bit of that. So he said, why don't you come horse racing with me? Well, I thought to myself, you know, to be asked to go horse racing with this guy is quite amazing, because he is one of the biggest owners of the world, in the world, with his partners. The guy is called Michael Tabor. He's got partners Derek Smith and Magnier, John Magnier, and their trainer Aidan O'Brien's one of the nicest men I've ever met in my life. And I thought, shall I go racing? Well, I can tell you, I can't wait, basically, every day to go racing now. The people I have met and the people I meet is quite unbelievable. You know, I have gone from a world where, you know, I've known people who have been quite affluent, but I've gone to people that I can't quite understand what money is. I'd just like to say that one of the highlights of going racing was we were in California last year for the Breeders' Cup, and we were in a box when a guy walked in, and I looked at this guy and I thought, I know you, but where would I know you from? You know, I'm in America, and I think, where would I know him from? And I looked, and he was quite an old man, and I thought, well, I must have met him racing in England. Michael introduced me to him, and we sat down, him and his wife, and we sat down and we had a very nice lunch, and he turned around to me and he said, what are you doing tonight, Alan? And I said, oh, well, I'm with Michael. He said, no, Michael had come with. He said, I want to take you out for dinner. And he took us out for dinner, and to say it was one of the highlights of my life, it really was, because although I wasn't quite sure who he was until I was introduced to him, he was one of my heroes in the music business. The guy's name is Burt Bacharach, you know, and he's coming to London July the 5th and 6th. Don't get on quick, get your tickets.
That sounds to me like your stories are still happening on a day-to-day basis. So are there any plans for another book?
Yes, I've written probably half a book is what I would like to say. Again, all the money will go to the hospice. That's the only reason I'm doing it. I just want to keep, you know, as long as I can, I want to try and find out ways of giving them, you know, what they deserve. Because, it, you know, until my wife was ill, I've never been in a hospice in my life. And I cannot tell you the feeling that they gave everybody and the help. And I just, even today, even talking about it makes me, like, become a bit overwhelmed sort of thing. So I thought, okay, I'll come up with some more stories, which I had done. I've also come up with the idea that I should get stories from other people in the racing business who might be able to tell me a story that they think would be enjoyable to the public. You know, I've got people like Graham Sharp, John Coleman, Steve Fluin, these are all people in the racing game, Jonathan Hobbs, and a few others, and they come up with some great stories. And I'm putting that into the book, and hopefully by the end of May, we'll probably be in a position to start trying to get it published. And hopefully from then on, we can get another chapter two, if you want to call it that, going. And as I say, whatever profit comes from it, it's going to one of the best causes I've ever come across in my life.
Follow our top sporting brand ambassadors, Davy Russell, Sylvester D'Souza, and Ryan Sidebottom for their exclusive news, views, and tips on all the major events with blogs and vlogs at starsportsbet.co.uk, begambleaware.org. Over 18 only.